Prabhu's today is the appearance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's 520 years ago on this day. It is called Palguni Purnima. It's one of the famous Purnimas of the year. So we have a mixed group here of visitors, devotees, friends, relatives of devotees. So I'll speak about quite a few things here. Try to say something for everyone's benefit to understand something about Mahaprabhu, chanting of the holy name, the Krishna consciousness movement, etc., why we live in the ashram, and so forth. So I'll try to mention a few things, something for everyone. So two things occurred 520 years ago on this day, and there was a build-up to that also. Now first off, 520 years ago, well, let me see, that's older than all of South America, Central America, North America, including Canada and Alaska. Those places did not exist 500 years ago. They existed, but only for the people who lived there. They didn't exist as far as Europe was concerned, or more or less because of, as far as Asia was concerned. That's called the New World. It did not exist 520 years ago. So if you're in that part of the world and you say 520 years ago, wow, that's a long time. But here in India, that's called modern history. This is modern history. 520 years ago is virtually nothing in terms of time. You can go downtown in Mysore in front of the Kaveri Emporium and you can buy 500-year-old coins on the street for 30 rupees each. But if you go to the New World, there is no such thing as a 500-year-old coin. If you found one, it would be an archaeological discovery. So we are now here in India. This is the old, old part of the world. And gradually it's coming to notice that this is the oldest part of the world. This is where it all began, here in India. When one of our friends arrived day before yesterday, I was telling him, yes, this is a very old place. Very green, very lush, and so forth, but India is a very, very old, old place. When Mahaprabhu appeared 520 years ago, that is considered, as Prabhupada used to recollect it, within the memory of everyone. That is not a long time ago. Therefore, the information we have about him, about his life, what he taught, what he wrote, etc., who his associates were, where he lived, and everything he did, is as fresh as a daisy. It is very fresh. It is not lost in antiquity to be speculated upon by archaeologists or philosophers or scholars or any such thing. Krishna? Well, Krishna appeared 5,000 years ago. That's a long time. By anybody's record anywhere in the world. That is a long time. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, a very short time ago. So our information, what we know about him, what he taught, everything is very fresh and not lost. So therefore it is a great relevance to us. So two things appeared on this day, 500 years ago. Just so you get a time frame, those of you who know something about the world, at the same time, there were people in the Western world in Europe. Pope Leo was there, and the famous Protestant reformist Martin Luther was there in Germany. This is the same time period. This time period was just at the end of the Dark Ages of Europe and dawning into the Age of Enlightenment, the Renaissance period. Many people are of the opinion that the Renaissance of Europe, it is caused by the appearance of Sri Chaitanya here in India. Because whenever the personality of Godhead appears in the world, there will be many good turns of good events. And it just so happens that during the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the new world itself was discovered in that time period, during that time. So, but so many things happened in the world, but two important things happened as far as we're concerned. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself appeared, and something else appeared at the same time. Anybody have a clue? The holy name of Krishna manifest at the same time. Prior to that, the name of Krishna, in terms of the Maha Mantra, it was lying in the Vedas, in some sloka form. It is there in the Upanishad, Mundak Upanishad. But it's simply lying there, rather silently. Obviously, it had been seen. It had even been chanted to some extent, but it was not at all prominent. When Mahaprabhu arrived, he caused the holy name to manifest. And it appeared on the lips of everyone in Navadvip on that particular evening. The village in which he appeared is called Navadvip. That's on the bank of the Ganges River in what's known as Bengal today. And there was an eclipse that evening, a lunar eclipse. So, the custom in India during an eclipse, everyone should put all the food, clothing, everything inside the house, lock up the house, and go to a sacred river or some sacred pond or something like this. And during the eclipse, one should engage in taking what is called a holy bath, a shnan, and chanting mantras for purification. And at this time, everyone found themselves engaged in chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, this is considered also then the appearance day of the Maha Mantra. A lesson to learn from that. It is there in the wisdom of the Vedas, but the Vedas, or any scripture of the world, is passive. You open the book and it does not sing. The Bhagavad Gita is called the Song of God. Open it, lay it on your desk. It doesn't make a sound. But it's called the Song of God. It doesn't make a sound. It does not sing until it comes through a proper person, a representative of Krishna. If someone is not a devotee of Krishna, they cannot tell you the actual meaning of Bhagavad Gita. It must then contain their speculation, their opinion. Krishna can only be understood through his devotees. This is also the message that is found in Bhagavad Gita. But yet many people over time have tried to become philosophers and scholars of the Bhagavad Gita, but not want to represent Krishna. When you hear Bhagavad Gita, the wisdom of Bhagavad Gita, from Krishna's devotee, when he represents the Gita, then you'll hear the Song of God. Then you can hear directly what Krishna says. So, scripture is passive. In some places, people just worship old books. And they rather shy from even reading them, such as the case in Amritsar and the Punjab. The big Granth Sahib is there, the great book is there. But it's seldom read to the people. The people have seldom read what was in it. Rather, it is there as some ominous authority, yet it means nothing. It's just paper, printed word on paper, until it is read, until the message enters your ear, it has no value. So the Maha Mantra is there, lying in so many printed versions of the Mundaka Upanishad. It had even been looked at, chanted occasionally, and gone back to peacefully sitting in a passive mode. But when Mahaprabhu came, then the holy name appeared also. And people felt spontaneously attracted to chant this Maha Mantra. Maha Mantra means that the benefit of all other mantras and all other knowledge in one mantra, Maha Mantra, the great mantra. There are not other Maha Mantras. In every age, there is a particular Maha Mantra. In this age, the names of Krishna. These three names, Hare, Krishna, and Rama. Sometimes people think Rama means Ramachandra. But Rama in Maha Mantra does not mean Ramachandra. It means also Krishna. As in the name Radha Raman. Rama means Krishna. Sometimes Rama means Baladeva. So in Maha Mantra, everything goes to Krishna. So, the Maha Mantra appeared, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, and the relationship of these two was manifest from his infancy. What is the most universal practice of every child, infant in the world? Crying. Everybody cries. And do you know something? They all cry the same. The Hindu children cry the same as the Christian children. The African children cry the same as the Russian children, as well as the same as the American Indian children or the Eskimos. They all cry the same way. They don't cry different. They all cry the same way. As if they all got together before birth and said, this is how we'll torment our parents. This is the song we'll sing. They all gasp for air and they all cry the same way. One little question to dwell on. How is that? If there is evolution, then why isn't there evolution? If there's evolution of species, why not evolution of crying in children? Why from the birth of any species of human being they all cry the same? Nature's showing us there's something here that unites us all, that is deeper than the color of our skin, the shape of our nose, the climate we're born into. It is deeper than the body we appear in this world. So Mahaprabhu used to cry, but his crying was only pacified when he heard the holy name of Krishna. And the ladies of the village used to get, they discovered this, and whenever he would cry, they would come to Mother Sachi's house and they would perform kirtan. Then he would smile and see the women of the village, and he was pacified. And sometime when they stopped, you know, we've all been children, many of you have brothers and sisters or children of your own, you rock them and you do different things and they finally shut up. And you put them down, and they come right back as if they're watching you leave the room. So Mahaprabhu was like that. He would pretend to be asleep, and then they'd stop chanting and start to go away. He'd start to cry again. Again, they would chant. In this way, he was engaging people in chanting the holy name, even as an infant. What is the difference between him and other infants? Bear this in mind. Nobody is the body. You're not this body. I am not this body. What is this body? We don't even understand, but we're happy to be here. We don't know how many hairs on our head, we'll speak of how many are in our nose. We don't know how our food digests. We only know when it doesn't digest or over digest. We don't know how we even walk. Next time you're standing up, try to figure out how you're standing up. You can't even figure out how you're doing it. You just do it. We have very little control over the world we live in, even the body we live in. We're not this body. We're born in a particular body, wherever it may be, according to karma. Karma is whatever we have accrued, is the word accrued?
Accrued
in a previous lifetime, in terms of good and bad. And spiritual knowledge, all these things. Spiritual knowledge, spiritual enlightenment, when it is not complete, it overrides karma. Karma is just plain old good and bad. And it's like sugar and salt. You know, you mix enough sugar, you can overpower the salt. You mix enough salt, you can overpower the sugar. You know, so sometimes people find themselves born in a very miserable place, in a very miserable set of conditions in life, and suffering tremendously. Yes, overpowered by the bad. How is this all worked out? It's called collective karma. We're born together to suffer. Misery loves company. We're born together. How is it? Like once I saw a busload of people, unfortunately, run over what, in one sense, was just an innocent lady. Boom! 40, 50 people. They all look out the window. Boom! The bus speeds off in India. The lady's run over. Obviously dead. And Vishnu Maharaj and I were riding by in another vehicle. We just observed this whole thing. And many things, if you're... mind works fast, you experience many emotions, oh that poor person, oh this, oh that. You feel for the loss of life of another human being, but another thing flashed from the plane of knowledge. And I thought, I wonder, could she have killed all those people in a previous life? She, whoever she was, he even, could she have been a war criminal from World War II, put so many people in a mass grave, and now the collective karma is... boom, they'll all kill her all at once. She killed them all at once, they'll kill her all at once. You cannot figure out karma. You cannot. You would have a better chance going out and counting all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the world and giving us an accurate tally, you would have a better chance at doing that than you would be figuring out karma. But that is what drives the world. The good and the bad karma. And it's like heating up a pan. If you heat it too much, it gets hot spots, cool spots on the pan. Especially if you cooked with stainless steel. It gets hot areas and cooler areas. And so there are areas of the world where more suffering will appear. That's called collective karma. But who is there in this world that doesn't suffer? The answer is nobody. Everybody suffers. Even you're a devotee of Krishna, a devotee of God, you also suffer. Sometimes those people appear to suffer more. You cannot unravel the mystery of this world. You cannot get back to its original day and how you got into this world and all these things and when it all began. They have which came first, the chicken or the egg? The question is, a chicken comes from an egg, but an egg comes from a chicken. So which one came first? Darwin? Mr. Darwin, if you're here, which one came first? No answer. No answer. Vedic knowledge says chicken came first. Chicken came first. Chicken was created, and the function of the chicken is it produces an egg. But if you just look at nature, you can't totally figure it out. You can't get to the origin. If you just study nature itself, you have to come to understand what is beyond nature. We are beyond this material nature. We are not nature. That is this body. We are not. We are born into this world according life after life. And how we came into this world, that is a conversation. That is something that has wondered the deep thinkers of the world for a long, long time. Trying to understand the free will of the living entity, the will of the Supreme, and how free will is misused, and all it is a very difficult subject to grasp with our small, small brain substances. So, Mahaprabhu, Krishna, and such avatars, they are not born according to karma, and they are the body. Krishna is not a soul living in a body. He is his body. Now, what does that mean? That means his body is not material. It is spiritual. Now, I had Dave. Where's Dave? Dave here? He's Dave, way out there. I had Dave watch a film. Did anybody else watch that film? The Blip We Know? Dave? Just you and Jayananda?
Jayananda.
I had him watch a film, and particularly the beginning of it was very interesting to us. It was a lot about science. It was a lot about physics. It was a lot about physics discovering there's another world. A parallel world, they say. The possibility there exists another time frame. The past may still exist. The future exists, although it hasn't come. Many speculations, these are speculations, through theoretical and experimental physics. And this isn't a new thing. I just wanted to give you a point of reference here. Find out that philosopher's name. There's Nobel Prize winners. Can you see that? Back sometime in the 1950s, the Nobel Prize was given to two physicists. Did you mention their names? Okay. Two physicists. They are the Italian-born Dr. Emilio Sigre, 69 years of age back then, 1959, and Dr. Owen Chamberlain of San Francisco. They were given the Nobel Prize of Physics for discovering the antimaterial particle. They concluded that there exists another world besides the one we see, which is, in their theory, just the opposite. Remember where this is and put it somewhere different. Okay. Which is just the opposite of this material world. It is going on at the same time. They call it the anti-material world. I mean, to use a word like spiritual isn't popular in scientific circles, so anti-material, that works. The anti-material world, and their conclusion was that the whatever they are, atoms, neutrons, electrons, they're spinning in opposite directions. And that makes them opposite worlds. And the two can never really meet, but if they were to collide, both worlds would be utterly destroyed. So, Nobel Prize is not a prize passed out to dummies, usually. These are your high-thinking human beings and high-achieving people, be it peace, music, literature, science. This is a high-achievement award. So somebody got that high-achievement award, which is a considerable amount of cash also, for the idea that there exists another world. Why until now did you never hear about this? In general, you meaning a person in the world. Why didn't you read this in the newspaper? Why isn't this world still being looked at? Why aren't we being told about this? Well, one reason is the research in that is very, very slow. They're practically not a half a paragraph past where they were when the whole theme started. But nonetheless, the possibility, another world, what is it? Where is it? Well, it is an anti-material world. It is a spiritual world. And it wasn't just minutely discovered in 1959 by a few theoretical physicists. It was discovered tens of thousands of years ago by enlightened sages, rishis, gurus, pure devotees of Krishna, Vishnu. The knowledge of this world and its structure and its permanence beyond destruction is the major topic of the Vedic literature. And how to awaken sleeping souls who, in that film you notice, they say we're conditioned, 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 conditioned. And how deep the conditioning goes, they're explaining, you see? What do you see? Does your eye see? Your eye doesn't see anything. Is it the brain that sees? The nerve endings in between? What actually sees? Does your brain see? And they prove, no, the brain doesn't see. It just relates some experience to the rest of the body. It's like some hub. It's like a hub that many computers work off of. What's actually happening here? So in this particular film, all these physicists arriving to some fundamental plane of consciousness. And then they go their own way. It ends up, this particular group are impersonalists. But they're physicists from here and there and around the world. And they begin with the explanation, a very detailed explanation of matter and what are all those things, from atoms and molecules and all those little things spinning, and they talk about appearing and disappearing particles of matter. It's like one of them says, where did they go? And then they come back. Where did they go? They appear and they disappear, inferring they went to the other side. They went to the other world. This is called Sankhya philosophy, the analytical study of material nature. There is a theistic analytical study of material nature presented by Kapila, and then there is another Kapila who was an atheist, and the conclusion is atheism or voidism. Buddhism is another. They are called religions, but these are not actually religions. These are sciences in the deepest meaning of the words science and knowledge, because they contain everything about the world and beyond. But they're all not the same. They are different processes, and they arrive at different levels of knowledge. One and one is one, right? Wrong. Not all the time. When you get up to theoretical math, that positive one and one equals one isn't there anymore. Even in the material sense. In the spiritual sense, one and one, maybe two, it may remain one. 1,000 add 1 remains the same, or more. Both things are accommodated. So many people's attempt to understand that other world is itself based on their experience of this world. They're analyzing with what they already know to be conditioning. They're observing, which they already know is not really an accurate experience. You see? So that's called the ascending process. Generally, that process ends in voidism. A little more advanced in that process ends in impersonalism. We're all one consciousness, momentarily divided by the bodies that we have. Enlightenment means just to emerge back like a particle of light into the great plane of light. That can be achieved through ascending. But there is another plane of knowledge that is called descending. That is called Saptabrahman. Descending plane of knowledge. That takes us beyond the void and through the light to the personality of Godhead and the indestructible plane of spiritual life known as Vaikuntha. Now, up until a certain time, this talk was religious. It's only religion. They believe, someone talked in terms of heaven and some said something about Vaikuntha. It was religion. But now, is it just religion or is it now science? Now it's being taken into the world of science, as it always has been science. Sometimes we preach against science ultimately to say they're not complete. Science is not complete. We preach against religion. Religion usually is the search for truth that kind of maxed out, short of the goal, and became an economic viability, a marketable product, a political hammer to beat the people into submission. This is what religions usually mean. Therefore, we do not say Krishna consciousness is a religion. It is a science. Not of understanding material nature, but of understanding the source of material nature, the source of consciousness, the source of everything. And that, in a word, that is Krishna. So, this isn't randomly going on, like the theory in evolution. It's not just arbitrarily going on, up to anybody to decide. It is going on just like the university. It is controlled. It is under control. It is under supervision. You may not see the dean of boys if you're a young man in college. You may not see the president. You may not see the council that sets your curriculum, but you follow it. And if you don't, well, many things can happen to you. You can fail, become less than average student, or even be thrown out. Be blocked from certain things. The world is not randomly going on. In fact, those of you who are a little enlightened on a broader scale of the world, you understand you're not free to do anything. You're programmed to do everything through advertisement, through subliminal advertisement, starting with your education in school. You do not have the freedom to think. You are conditioned. I thought an interesting point they made, a little speculative, but in that film they pointed out that when these aborigines somewhere in these islands saw the ships come, they couldn't see them. These big old, 17th century sailing ships cruised up on the horizon of their little Polynesian island, and when they looked out there, they didn't see them. They saw whatever, but they didn't see ships. They saw something. Dark clouds, what it was. They had no point of reference. Therefore, how could they see it? If a child has never seen a gun, never been told about a gun, and you lay a gun in front of it and say, go get the gun. What's a gun? There's no point of reference. They might not even notice it laying there. Or curiosity, and eventually, they say in this, this little docudrama that they were doing, that then the shamans, means the priest, they noticed some disturbance on the horizon, and as they began to see, then, lines, strings, cloths, wood came into their perception, and then they saw the ships. But they couldn't even see them. Extreme. You are conditioned. You think you are free. You think you are making a choice in life. You are making no choice in life at all. You are simply riding the wave of your karma, and somebody else's karma next to you is trying to influence you in the world. And that means the corporate world, the advertising world, the world that you perceive through the television, the billboards, the sounds, the music, everything is telling you something. There is no freedom in this world. There is only a word without meaning. Freedom exists in the spiritual world. There is freedom, no conditioning, and there we have complete free will. And never a moment's misuse of it. Never a moment's misuse of it. So, from that world, not only do avatars come, but representatives, devotees of that world come to this world. It is not that both are going and one hardly knows about the other. The heads of that world, they know fully about this world. And they come themselves, Krishna, avatars, come themselves to this world to do good to the conditioned soul, those who are living in this world of ignorance, in this world of illusion. And Krishna's devotees come. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is considered a devotee of Krishna, and he is also considered an avatar of Krishna, which are true. Both, actually. From the scholar's point of view, they say he was a great devotee who led a great reform in India and so on and so forth. This is true, but generally we say, no, that's not good enough. We accept Krishna, Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, avatar, Kali Yuga avatar. He is Bhagavan, the personality of God himself. But bear in mind, they are also right. How they are right. How Mahaprabhu is a devotee. How he's a devotee. They're right. He is a devotee. He played as a devotee. How he actually is a devotee. Because he's not just Krishna. He's Radha Krishna. And who is Radha? Radha is the topmost devotee. So in this particular avatar of Krishna, Krishna comes along with his topmost devotee in one form. So there's Latin argumentum baculum or something.
Baculum. Huh? Argumentum baculum.
Yeah. Argumentum baculum. This is going on in philosophy. You are not this body, but when you go back to Godhead, you are this body. Well, what does that mean? Yes, it is a different world. Those are not souls in bodies. We are souls, but what is a soul? What is your idea of a soul? My first idea of a soul, it's a record book. It was kind of like a report card in school, and God had one with your name on it. And you got white marks and black marks. People conceived the soul of just a record. And this word is an English word. There's some word for it in different languages. In Sanskrit, it's called Atma. And Atma means a unit of consciousness. A unit of consciousness that springs from the reservoir of all consciousness that is Krishna. In a word, that is Krishna. We are a unit of consciousness. Some of these scientific thinkers, they are now applying consciousness. And this is a big step forward. Some of our friends are scientists, physicists, neurobrain surgeons, and a whole bunch of the rest. They attend conferences around the world. There are quite a number of Nobel Prize winners these days. Scientists from different fields acknowledging consciousness. And this is a huge step forward for the modern world understanding of life, to factor in consciousness in understanding the world. But the Sankhya philosophy explains, and it's the Vedas have their own unique way. Through stories, through different ways, the philosophy is presented. And even when they come to fully embracing consciousness, they'll not come to the ultimate conclusion. This is explained in Sankhya philosophy. That even when consciousness entered the world, means when all the elements, in science we speak about an original primordial soup was one of the old names for it, the dense matter called the big chunk. Like, where did it begin? Where did it start? Go to school, ask your teacher, where did it come from? Oh, you came from Tamil Nadu. No. Where did all of it come from? And it comes back to a solid mass of matter called the big chunk, or a real soupy, gassy plane of matter, which they used to call the primordial soup. Where did the matter come from? That dense matter, which is both dense matter and primordial soup, in Sankhya that is called Mahatattva. This is where it all comes from. And everything is in that Mahatattva, except consciousness. The world is dead without consciousness. So at a certain point in this explanation in Sankhya, consciousness enters the world. Still the world remains dead. No life. So even after adding consciousness and science fully embracing consciousness and adding that into the equation of everything about life, be it the environmental issues or the health issues of an individual or the origins issue, when they add consciousness, they still can't get to the ultimate conclusion. there will still be problems in the theories. Then Sankhya said, then the super consciousness entered, the Parabrahma. We're called Brahma. Then the Parabrahma entered. Then the world began. Then there was life. Then there was evolution. Then there was creation. All the things that you see. Look how old this place is. Huh? I was saying how old this place is. Look how green and fresh it is. How is it possible? Take away the consciousness and something immediately dies. There is consciousness everywhere. Consciousness is what sustains this world. But it is not independent of Parabrahma superconsciousness. And there lies the personality aspect of the truth. All that we experience is not superior to personality. Nature is the product of a personality. There is a God. There is a personality. It's a big step from science to that, and it's probably going to take them centuries more to get there, if they get there at all. But there is a possibility that they even hear messages from Vaikuntha with their machinery. It's very remote. I wouldn't put any of my chips on that bet, but there is a possibility that they contact messages. Sound is a unique thing. It doesn't disappear. It just dissipates. And it gets beyond the range of our acquiring it. But it's there. The words of all the rishis, the words of the Vedas, it's all there in the universe. It seems to be gone. But there's research, different type of research going in, trying to get out of the present into what would be theoretically the past, where this sound or this information may still exist. It's possible, but it's remotely possible. But it is possible, but not probable. Better put your attention on the Vedic body of knowledge and have a fresh review of everything. Some people say, oh, you shouldn't ask that question. You ask the question sometimes, even in, educated circles, science circles. Well, you shouldn't ask that question. Particularly in religion, this comes up all the time. You shouldn't ask that question. There was Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel. Adam died. Where did everybody else come from? There was only mom and the kid left. You shouldn't ask that question. But Krishna consciousness is just the opposite. What is your question? Don't be brain dead. What is your question? Answer a question. Don't ask a stupid question. Ask questions. Search for the truth. Ask questions. We don't believe in that philosophy. Don't ask questions. No, ask questions. And if you don't find the answers, keep looking until you do. And it's, yes, one person told my sister, said, well, we're not like the Hare Krishnas that think they know everything. And that's what her pastor told her. And that was supposed to be like false pride, that we know everything. Well, should I deny the truth? Should I deny the knowledge? When they were burning people alive for thinking about flying in Europe, they could think about interplanetary space travel in India. Easy journey to other planets. There's been talk about going to other planets in India for thousands of years. There's even places in the Vedas that describe spaceships, rocket fuels, all kinds of things. How to sustain yourself in space. Now the question is, well, maybe they did or they didn't do it. But the first point is, they could think about it. So broad was their knowledge. So broad was their civilization. Broad, advanced. But in Europe at the same time, you could get yourself burned as a heretic for even thinking about such a thing as flying. The most convenient way of travel today. Flying. That's how everybody from a foreign land got here, by flying. But just, 300 or 400 years ago, you could be burned alive for even thinking of such a thing. For thinking that the earth circled around the sun, you could be put to death. Because many religions don't actually represent the truth. They are systems of political control or economic tools to mold a people into some form of progress. The Krishna consciousness is not a political movement, and it actually has no political agenda, although it sometimes offers political opinion. It is not about economics. one preacher was charged, and someone said, he preaches, if you come to Jesus, you get rich. He said, well, what should I preach? Poverty? And everybody laughed. And it's like, why don't you try that for a while? Why don't you preach poverty and tell people just be happy with what you got? Instead of thinking you're always going to get more and more and more, and Jesus can give it to you. Your trump card, your ace in the hole, you know, your crazy deuce, you know. Why didn't I hear? It's easier for a camel to enter the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter my Father's kingdom? Wasn't that something Jesus also said? So, yeah, Mr. Preacher, why don't you preach poverty? Maybe that would help the world. But he just, should I preach poverty? Ha ha, everybody laughed. And the question was just blown away. The reporter should have said, yeah, why don't you give it a try? Let's see what happens. Run the experiment. You know, the American experience. Run the experiment and see what happens. Koitapa Dharma, cheating religion. Religion has nothing to do about increasing your wealth. It doesn't have anything to do about increasing your life. Many people tend to come to religion at the end of life with the hope they won't die. Or the hope that when they do die, they'll be on the good side of things. You know, and not be thrown in the boiling pot of oil, or get a better next life. In India, they want a better next life and all these things. But then they're young, they don't want to apply themselves. They save it for old age. Religion, this Krishna consciousness, is not for old age. It's for from the moment you're born, if possible, as young as you can get. Some of these kids have come into Krishna consciousness at 5, 6 years old, of their own will, of their own choice. They've made that choice, attracted to Krishna. It is not something, as Prahlad said, that is kept for old age. It is not something that is locked up in temples, in an old books, for only a few people to be knowledgeable of. It is for everyone from the very beginning of life to the very last breath of life. To cultivate consciousness. And consciousness in its purest form, it is called at this time Krishna consciousness. It means total awareness of the supreme origin of everything, the personality of Godhead. And within that, that comes your self-awareness, who you are. Not who you were in so many lifetimes. Why would you need to know? Why would you want to know? Because so many lifetimes just means so many suffering, and not just your own. It's not that, you had many lifetimes and you suffered. No, you caused people to suffer. You did bad things. It's not possible to have been in this world and been a goody two-shoes for the last 200 million lifetimes. And you've had many more than that. People think previous life, was it 2 or 3? How about a number bigger than the world can tell us? 100 quadrillion, trillion, billion. Yes. And you weren't an angel in every life. So why would you want to remember all that? Why would you want to remember? And self-realization does not mean to remember your past lives. It has nothing to do with it. It does not mean to predict anything futuristic in this world. What's going to happen? Sometimes a Vaishnava offers an opinion, and sometimes it doesn't come true. Or it comes true after such a long time, it becomes irrelevant from his time. Nobody living is around to hear that heard him say it. There are many things like that. But people tend to think. One man also told me, he said, no, I've realized. He pointed to his head. It was a long time ago, a young guy in college. No, I realized. He pointed to the wrong place. If he would have said, I've realized some truth, and pointed, here means internal. Here means the heart. Here means within consciousness, generally. You don't go, I've really understood this. But when you point to the head, that means you're identifying with mind and intelligence. And when you go like this, and go, I was really touched by what he said. I go, I was, really hurt by what was said. You don't go, I was really hurt by what was said, right? When it comes to feeling, you go here. And feeling is closer to consciousness than knowledge. Knowledge is a limitation. Feeling starts to transcend knowledge. Emotion, that is called bhava, spiritual feeling. Even material feelings sometimes, they astound us, they transcend the given knowledge. It's historical fact. Mothers know their sons are killed in wars many times before the telegram arrives. Your father knew his brother died in the middle of the night before the phone call arrived. Intuition, relation with people, feeling transcends knowledge. It's going to arrive by a voice on a phone a few minutes later. How is that? There is no scientific explanation for that, as we know science today. As we know science today, it is very limited. It is almost a useless vehicle for pursuing the ultimate goal of life. It has done more harm to the world than it will ever be able to do good in terms of repairing the world. So self-realization is not an awakening of knowledge. Knowledge comes along with that, but ultimately subsides to give full freedom to the plane of feeling. First guided by the knowledge, and then by the feeling. And what is feeling? The highest feeling is love. Where does that word love, if you speak about love, spiritual love, you'll never understand what it is, because the love that you have here in this world is all about brother, sister, mother, father, boyfriend, girlfriend. That's all. It's just about that. And that is not, in any sense, an expression of pure love. That is a love that is misguided. Mainly, it is experienced because we're related bodily, or we provide enjoyment for each other. Love is a very misunderstood word. And when people, they think, a lot of times, I've met people, they think, oh yeah, the Swamis, yes, these Swamis, they're into love, you know, and it's like, how many girlfriends do they have? They think like that. And rightfully so, because some of them did. So many cheaters talking about love. But what is that love? Lust. It is some lower relationship. Love of Krishna is a completely different sentiment. It springs fully from the consciousness plane, conscious plane. Not from anything to do with the sensations of this world, which we perceive through this body, through this mind, and through intelligence. So first, we have to purify consciousness. Come to the plane of pure consciousness, called Krishna consciousness. And then we can cultivate love of God. That is called prema. There is a process for that. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he came for two purposes. Generally we say first, he came to spread the holy name of Krishna. This has an all-purifying effect on everyone and anyone, favorable or unfavorable. Antagonists, as well as procrastinist, as well as enthusiast, the holy name of Krishna doesn't discriminate. It goes to everyone, and it delivers a good benefit. Whether it's recognizable by everyone, well, that's not necessarily so. But the benefit is there. It's some help, some purifying help is there. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was interested to see the holy name of Krishna spread in every town and village of the world. That's been done to a great extent, but there are new towns and villages coming up all the time. And the people that lived in the old towns and villages, well, they're passing on and new people are filling up the villages. So it is a never-ending work. It is a fulfillment of a never-ending prophecy, or a never-ending work, or the fulfillment of a particular prophecy. To have the holy name in every town and village of the world. Ultimately, it is said in the parts of the Vedas that predict, that do predict, that there will be one religious principle in this age. There will come a time when the only religious principle is chanting the holy name of Krishna. No other religious principle. No other religious system. Now you see something today, and you think, it will never change. But look at the history. Everything changes. Governments changes. Empires come and go. Sometimes right in front of our eyes, some big corporation. I mean, when the company called Pan American, when I grew up and airplanes first appeared in the sky to carry passengers, right? Pan Am. I mean, subconsciously, it was eternal. It was the Pan American Airlines. It would just always be there. And when they went bankrupt and ceased to exist, it was like, what? They don't exist anymore? They went out of business? It was like, for many people, it was a shock. It was like, It was a shock. They actually think in terms of this world forever. People think the American Empire will be there forever. Forever means, yeah, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. It will always be there. But anybody with even half a brain knows, I don't think so. Maybe 100 more years? Maybe 10 more? Who knows? But always there? I don't think so. This world is constantly changing. Things are constantly changing. So there will come a time when Krishna consciousness, chanting the holy name of Krishna, is the predominant religious conception for the whole world. And then it will also decline into obscurity and then vanish. That's the way of this world. The only place where pure consciousness remains forever is in that other world we spoke about in the beginning, the Vaikuntha world. In the spiritual world, there, Krishna consciousness, pure consciousness, never diminishes. It is always in full expression. It never diminishes. But in this world, it comes into prominence and it goes after some time. Some people say that beginning to end runs about 10,000 years, of which we've passed 500 to 800 already. But what do we care about 10,000 years from now? We'll let somebody else figure that out. So Mahaprabhu's main thing, first thing we say, to see the holy name of Krishna spread everywhere in every town and village. But there is another aspect. And that is the internal aspect. And of the two, it is actually the second, which is the first, and the first, which is the second. In order of primary importance, the internal development is more important. But in order to do that, there must be Sankirtan, there must be propagation of the holy name, there must be the extended hand of helping others, and not just trying to help oneself. Why? Because we have to learn to be selfless and give up selfishness. Selfishness. It is the main cause of trouble in this world. Selfishness leads to greediness, leads to exploiting the environment. It goes on and on, racial hatred. Somebody makes a joke about your God, you go around killing people. All these things stem from one fault, selfishness. And even in Krishna consciousness, it's not that the day we join, all selfishness gone. No, it is a process. We are willing to serve Krishna, but we want to put our personal life in order first. That is a manifestation of selfishness. It is allowed to a certain extent, based on the fact that, well, when they do get it together and then finally serve Krishna fully, then they'll become more purified. But there's also the risk that you never come to that platform. Because the selfishness rules. Spiritual life is not a matter of life and death. What did I say the other day? It's not a matter of life and death. It's more important than that. Your house is on fire. I told Mother Mohini, she came here to spend some time in the ashram, and everything went wrong in her world. Son, daughter, someone stole her car. You know, when someone steals your car, you got to go to the police, you got to follow this stuff. Yeah, she's probably going to lose it. And she's reading in Sridhar Maharaj's books, he's telling the story of Bhakti Siddhanta saying, don't tell me your house is burning, that you will go extinguish the fire in your house, and then you'll come back. Let it burn. It's simply burning that which charms you. Get out of that fire. Don't run into that fire. Nothing is more important. Now, I pointed this out too. There are people who have less knowledge and less awareness of the ultimate reality than devotees, and they're 1,000 times more dedicated than the devotees to the point they die for their religion. You know how many of them are out there? They're out there in the world. Lots of them, especially in the Islamic world. By comparison, they have a fig of the knowledge, a fig of the awareness, a fig of the compassion, a fig meaning a small fragment of what we found in Krishna consciousness. Muhammad was just killing people left, right, and center. Mahaprabhu was not doing that. We're following Mahaprabhu, they're following Muhammad. Muhammad was killing people. He didn't accept what he said. He just cut your throat and moved on. Christianity shared about the same kind of history, even before him. And people are giving their life, they're giving their money. I know so many Christians, they don't donate. The church just takes their money right out of their account every month, 10, 15, 20%. People sign over their properties when they die. These televangelists, you know why they're on the TV, don't you? Because they're making about $1 million an hour. And for what? They have something, and they are so dedicated to that. They give so much to that. They sign over their family fortunes when they're old. This happens every single day. They're so in. They are so rich that they can spend millions of dollars every year preaching to Hindus in India who won't spend 10 cents. They'll give 10 cents in a hundi box. And they would never think about giving 20%, 30%, what is it, 50% of their money. And many of us devotees, even who are initiated, we're the same way. We want everything first right in our world and then serve Krishna over here. And I can tell you by experience, it will never come to pass. I have sometimes said, many of you put Krishna at the top, and Guru, Krishna's representative, he's four or five on the list. No, sorry, Krishna's not at the top. The job's at the top. That's right, the job. Job is at the top. If the boss says you're going to Bombay, you're going to Detroit, you're out of here. There you go. You go to Hong Kong, boom, there you go, right? If your guru says, I want you to go to Zurich, it's like, he's not in charge. The boss is in charge. And after that, it's the family and extended family. They're in charge, huh? Then, I forget who was three, family, extended family, second and third. And then came Krishna. And fifth was Guru. But actually, it's first Guru, then Krishna. That's the priority to get out of this world. And who's an example of that? Somebody thinks, well, that's a nice philosophy. That'll probably get you set up for retirement. Everything for Guru and then Krishna. Krishna's representative. And then everything he will spend for Krishna. Everything he will do for Krishna. And if he can't do that, he shouldn't be in that position. Krishna's representative is dear to Krishna. The example? Srila Prabhupada. He's the example. He's the example, the most current example of that we have. Then you can go on. Srila Sri Maharaj, Srila Puri Maharaj. And you'll see in all their lives, there's a day of choice. Is it Krishna I want, or this world? And I told Bhakti Priya, when Dave came here, I said, well, you know, you run the risk. If Dave finds Krishna, he might forget about you. That was true with your father and your mother. He found Krishna and your mother had to go seek him out. Well, what about us? Well, if you're into it, there isn't us. And if you're not, there isn't. Oh, that's very extreme. But what are we talking about here? You mean to tell me if somebody said, look, all we got to do is get over this little wall right here and there's eternity. And you can see it from here. Beautiful beaches, nice ocean, coconut trees, and lakes, whatever you like, mountains, it's all there. You just got to get over this wall. I mean, we'd kill each other getting over this wall. But it just doesn't come like that. Okay, here's a wall, you just got to climb through this hole, and there it is. It starts with you, your knowledge, your consciousness, your commitment. It's not just about jumping over a wall. You have to jump over thousands of walls, thousands of hurdles in life to reach the ultimate goal. And if it's just talked about from the point of philosophy and religion, we live in the age of doubt. We believe in science. Science has discovered this a long time ago. They're very silent about it. They're very limited in their understanding about it also. But the leaders of our modern world, they say there is another world. Krishna consciousness offers detailed information of that world and how you can get there. Details. Not like heaven. You ask a Christian about heaven, and you'll get a picture of a swimming pool, everybody sitting around in a lounge chair, and Jesus serving lemonade. In a Roman toga, with blue eyes. When he had black hair and brown eyes, and he never wore a Roman toga. He was a Jew. But that's their conception of heaven. It's just like, go to any five-star pool, any palace pool in the world, and how long can you hang out at the poolside drinking Nimbu Pani? There's got to be more to heaven than that. Well, in Krishna consciousness, you'll find what you want to know about going on there. There's so much information. And then you're told, but what can we say? It's only a fragment because it's an infinite world. But the principle is different. Jesus or any other saint, he is not there to serve us. God is not there to serve us. It's us who will be serving the Nimbu Pani to him. We will be serving him, pleasing to him. Even the pagans of Greece and Rome, they call them the pagans, they had a clearer concept of divinity than the world's modern Abrahamic religions do. They had an idea of serving Zeus, Apollo. They had an idea of serving that god. That there, when they would go there, there would be service. They had a clearer idea. And they were the, you know, what they call the pagans. But they had more of an idea of that. Now the idea of religion is God is there to serve you. And this is not any aspect of the truth, actually. We're there to serve him. The parts are there to serve the whole. The hand is there to serve the body. The body doesn't serve the hand. The body is automatically nourishing. The hand receives its nourishment automatically, but it has its function to work for the benefit of the whole. And then it is automatically nourished. When we water a tree, when a bush is planted, and we water it, do we just pour water on the leaves? No. The leaves are like humanity and social interest. Just to serve that, that is not service to God. And that does not do ultimate good to us. Water the root, and everything prospers, or everything is benefited after that. So the center has to be served. The center means Krishna. We are to serve him. That world is a place of serving him. If we talked about it for the rest of our life and even detailed it, still a small amount can be known. Because from the finite, you can't understand that much about the infinite. What is the infinite? What is eternity? What does your mind allow you to think eternity is? In most cases, it's a long time. That's eternity. A long time. But eternity means no time. No time. It's like, well, wait a minute. Well, you have no experience of no time. There's either past, present, or future. Time is locked in to this world. And it can't be breached. It's called Kala Chakra. It's all pervasive in this world. It's the lock. Time. We've heard about an eternal place, forever and ever. What's that mean? Our mind, which is a material element, just perceives eternity in terms of a long time. We cannot conceive with our mind. No time. No time means no past. No future. Freedom of movement. No past, present, future. Everything is always present. It's a moment. Always an auspicious, it's been described as an auspicious moment. Everything is there. Now that's impossible. What kind of senses, if we all start talking, it's like, hey, I can't be quiet, I can't hear. I can only hear one or two people talking the most. Like every time you're on the phone talking and someone talks to you, you get this, two people talking. How are you going to listen to 100 people talking? How can everything be happening at the same moment with no past, no future? And then the present is also, you say the present, that's just something between the future and the past. If there's no future and there's no past, there's no present either. Present is an aspect of time. Past is an aspect of time. Future is an aspect of time. There is no time. There is no Kala Chakra there. That is eternity, but we can only philosophize a little bit about it, say what it's not, what it's not, what it's not, and try to like know that, yeah, it's not what we can think in our brain. But it exists. Beyond this world, eternity. So if you know this, and you really know this, then what matters in your life? Your salary? Your future? I'll tell you the future. Somebody says, Swamiji, you know the future? I go, yeah, I know the future. Everybody's going to die. That's the future. Sooner or later, you first, me first, God only knows, but it's sure. And everybody knows it. My father was a wise man. He said, son, there's only two things you have to do. Die and pay taxes. And I told my sister, you know, I beat the second one. I don't pay taxes. I'm tax exempt. I'm a 501c3, an ADG. We don't pay taxes. But the first one, no chance. Everyone has to die. And yes, there is a big mystery. What will be the proof? What will be the proof? Huh? Your realization will be the proof. Your knowing yourself, that is a proof. We can't really prove to the world that Vaikuntha exists, although somebody's discovering an anti-material world. There exists another plane, a fifth dimension, or a sixth dimension, or whatever it is. But how to prove that ultimately to people? You can't. It's unprovable. Therefore, faith, what we call faith, is required. But faith is not an act of stupidity. Faith is an act of intelligence. Faith is an act of greater experience. Otherwise, why do you put your money in the bank? Why do you believe in that credit card? That when you put your money in the bank and you come to India, you can go to a debit machine and get it. Because you believe. And if somebody says, oh, you're a fool to believe that, you go, what do you mean, a fool to believe that? The system is there. The experience is there. The institution is there. Well, if any intelligent person can believe in this system. And you have many people that say, yes, it works. The first time I heard about it, I didn't believe it. One friend came and he said, yeah, I can just draw some money from my credit card on David Rogers Road and give it as a donation. I said, I don't think so. I don't think you can do that here in India. India's a little backwards. But the machines had come and he had his money in America and Gaur Govinda, and he drew out $500 and I was shocked. So I gotta get me one of these. He said, well, you know, you gotta put the money in the bank to begin with. Oh, it's a system. I see. Now all these new systems are coming in India. Previously you couldn't get it. You buy the car, you pay cash. You can buy anything in the West on credit. And in India, nothing is credit. Everything is cash, 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 cash. Now the system came. You can buy a car on credit. If you have a job and just a few things, you can buy a car. And boom, 100 million cars on the highway in 1 year or something. But previously that didn't exist. And people still don't believe in ordering online. They got whole propaganda programs to get you to click the order button. Isn't it right? Every time I go to order something online for the computers, ultimately I just sit there and jitter in front of them. What if it does it twice? What if somebody steals my credit card number? I'm like, I don't know about this. And this is a secure server. What's that? You know? And then I go, okay, we'll try. You know? Hey, it showed up 2 days later. Wow, that was really good. You know? The experience. Then build your faith, the knowledge, the experience. And then there's the line, you can't go back in Krishna consciousness. Cross a line of experience by chanting the holy name of Krishna, taking prasadam, hearing the knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and such, and associating with the devotees. You cross that line, you can never go back. Your life is ruined. And as much as you try to remain spiritual and be a materialist, you'll know the meaning of ruined. You'll feel pain. You give up the materialism, and the thought is, oh, I guess I'll just be a beggar. And I can surrender to Krishna. But I haven't seen him make too many people beggars yet. I said that. I'm ready to give everything. And then he gave back so much more. But if the calculation is there, well, I will give whatever little I have to Krishna. He's given it back 10 times. That's Balaji. And that's a rumor. That's not true. That's only a rumor. I'll give to Krishna, and it will come back to me more. If you have that calculation, you give to Krishna, it will just be gone. And you'll feel it. It's gone. He doesn't. Krishna is not after your money. I'm not after your money. Huh? Although, whatever you have to offer, I can accept. But that's not what we're after. We're after devotion. Krishna himself is addicted to devotion. There is a relationship between all individuals and the supreme individual. A reciprocal relationship. We have devotion to offer. And he has love to give in exchange for that. Love does not come from us. It comes from him. First we offer devotion. Then he offers love. Then we know what is love for Krishna. It comes from Krishna. It comes from Radharani. love does not come from the jiva soul per se. It is a gift. It is a gift to be purchased through devotion. Devotion itself is so sweet, even without having that pure love of Krishna. Devotion. Even in this world, giving, there's a saying, giving a gift is better than receiving one. I mean, the parents, they get some gifts at Christmas too, or on their birthdays, but what really makes them happy is giving to others. Giving to their children, giving to a friend, or giving. Krishna consciousness is a competition of giving. Try to give the most. Not competitively, but just try to give more to Krishna than he can give to you. And that's a losing battle. But it's so sweet, a battle. It is worth fighting and worth losing. And who knows, he might let you be victorious sometime. We've heard that and some people pray for God to give them their bread. This is pious. But we pray, Krishna, please eat this bread. Please accept our bread. And nothing would make us happier than if we offered, and Braja Kishore baked 5 trays of bread, and Bhakti Priya made a nice cake, and Krishna ate it all, and the plate was empty. We'd be screaming, running around the ashram. It'd be the happiest day of our life. There was not a crumb left for us. That would be, hallelujah. That would be honey bowl. Ultimately, that's a rare day. That's a rare day. Sometimes Krishna does eat the offer. It's a rare day. But generally, Krishna's got so many offerings being offered to him all over the world. And he leaves so much prasad. That is there. That is when we're worshipping Krishna in the deity form. One man asked Prabhupada, one college man, he said, Swami, have you seen Krishna? And the disciples who were sitting around in Hyderabad, we all went, oh, bad question. Because there's so many people saying, oh yes, I've seen Krishna, he's doing this, he's doing that, very cheaply they're telling, and just confusing people. And Prabhupada didn't like those questions. You've seen Krishna. So then Prabhupada said, do you think we are fools? And those boys said, no, Swami. You think all these foreigners, these Westerners, you think they're fools? Simply they're coming here and nothing is there? They're telling Krishna, Krishna, and nothing is there? Do you think they are fools? No, Swami, no. So he wasn't answering the question. He was just asking another question. Do you think these people are fools? Then, no, Swami, we don't think they're fools. And he said, so, do you want to see Krishna? Oh, this is a popular guru's thing. Oh, do you want to see Krishna? Oh, yes, Swami, do you want to see Krishna? They said, he said, okay, you come tomorrow morning, 4:30, Mangalarti. No, I mean, I want to see the cloud Krishna, I want to see that Krishna. No, this Krishna. Here, first Krishna is here. Archivigraha. And now, take this photo and shop all over South India and find another and come back here. Try to find this Krishna anywhere, from here all the way down to Kanyakumari and back. And the answer is, you can't. You can come back with some great pictures and great shots of temples of Balaji and Narayan and Ramachandra and so many things. But Vrindavan Krishna, Vrindavan Chandra, you won't find. He's not everywhere. He's only residing in the place where his pure devotees dwell. That's where he stays, not in other places. Vaikuntha Bhav of other sampradayas, it's got mix of mukti and calculation of wealth. Here, Krishna is present to accept everything we have to offer, or offer everything to Krishna. He's here for that purpose. If we try to make a market out of our devotion, Krishna goes. He leaves. He does not stay. He is not in the market category. He has too many high-priced buyers already. They are ready to give everything. And I'm not, the everything I'm not talking about is not your wealth. It's not yours anyway. It already belongs to him. Huh. You own nothing. Huh? And the day of that truth is death. We own nothing. And we don't own the body and the shirt we've been living in for life. Gone. Huh? What he's after is your devotion. And this is the most beneficial thing to every living entity, is to give that devotion to the source of everything. Give that devotion to Krishna. That is the most fulfilling experience. And you'll taste that here, whether you're just a weekend visitor, first-time visitor, coming and going, born in a family of devotees, you'll find that more and more irresistible. But mark my words, there is a line. And when you cross that line, you are Krishna's, and he is yours. And that's eternal. And then, the things that Swami sometimes shouts about, and all these things, they'll just come off in your head just like bells. You know? They'll just come on like lights, like, yes. That's what he was trying to say. That's what he was talking about. Nothing is more important than this, Krishna consciousness. Nothing. And every bad thing you can find in the world goes on because of a lack of this. The more the good of Krishna consciousness spreads, then the better the world can be. Even the environmental issue, which is so noble, has a tag. Save Earth now, enjoy her later. No, save Earth now, period. Why enjoy? It's the whole enjoying spirit. Many of the environmentalists are like, well, this is like your mother said, well, don't eat all the cake in one day. Save some for tomorrow. Enjoy tomorrow. Don't eat it all up today. But, you know, the senseless enjoyers, they just want to scoff up the whole world, just suck up the rainforest and eat it all in one day. But the environmentalists, if you listen carefully, what a great amount of them are saying is, well, don't eat it all today, make sure we grow enough for tomorrow. Therein lies the problem. Exploitation. Enjoyment. We're to be custodians of this world, not enjoyers of this world. It is called Mali. Mali means a gardener, a custodian. There are different types of Malis. Even Vanamali is there, means the forest gardener, the custodian of the forest. We're not just to go in and rip the forest apart and do whatever we like with that energy, because we are here to enjoy. When we develop the service mentality to Krishna, then we can automatically be servant to this whole world. But if we try to serve the world, neglect the service of Krishna, we do not come to the same platform of awareness, and we will meet with frustration, because the world is a difficult master. A very difficult master. Many people go to serve in the war zones and to help, and then they're killed. They're sometimes killed by the people they're trying to give relief to. The world is a difficult master. But Krishna is not like that. Krishna is a very caring, a very affectionate master. So serve Krishna, then we can do good to the world. And put Krishna first. That's today's message. Go bring it in.